Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast. From newsounds.org and streaming live on Facebook, I'm John Schaefer. If you've followed the career of Vijay Iyer, or even if you've just followed his appearances here in our studio over the years, you'll know that he leads multiple musical lives. He's a composer of string quartets and orchestral works, an electronic musician. He's done a series of politically potent albums with the spoken word artist Mike Ladd. And of course, he's one of the most celebrated jazz artists of our time, a three-time winner of Downbeat's Artist of the Year Award. And there are lots of ways that jazz presence makes itself felt. The Trio, celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. I happen to be a fan of his solo work, but his sextet is responsible for Vijay Iyer's most recent album called Far From Over. And that sextet, a powerhouse lineup, as you'll hear, has joined us for this edition of the Soundcheck Podcast, and they're going to start us off by playing the title track, Far From Over. That is the Vijay Iyer Sextet, live here in the Soundcheck studio with the title track from the Sextet's most recent album called Far From Over, bringing Vijay Iyer back to our studio here in Lower Manhattan. Great to see you again.
Nice to see you.
As usual, you've put together an astonishing lineup of talent here in the studio today. Let me just introduce everybody to the rest of the band. Jeremy Dutton in the corner behind our drum kit. Yeah. Stefan Crump playing the double bass. Graham Haynes, although he's now holding a cornet in his hand, was just playing a flugelhorn. On alto sax, Steve Lehman, and on tenor sax, Mark Shim. And so you've got a band that is full of composers, mm-hmm. in addition to being all fine players themselves. How composed are the, I mean, you've done string quartets and ensemble pieces and, you know, concert works. How composed are the skeletons on which these improvisations hang?
I think it's like a lot of music in this tradition or this history. You know, when you think of a tune by Thelonious Monk, there's a lot of detail in it, but every sound you make when you're playing it is still your own choice.
Right.
And that includes the way you extemporize from within and off of what's on the page. So it's really, it's in that tradition, I would say. It's got organization, it's got rhythmic structure, it's got a sort of harmonic progression in most cases, now though not all.
Mm-hmm.
It mainly just has more rhythmic detail than you usually find on like a lead sheet for a Tin Pan Alley song or something
right.
like that.
Right.
Like many people nowadays, I write specific parts for the drums, for the bass, so it's not just a bunch of hash marks. So it means that there's something to deal with, but then, of course, that doesn't need to be played verbatim all the time.
Right.
Just like if you look at a lead sheet for How High the Moon, that doesn't mean you're going to play it squarely.
Like right. That, you know. And for folks who haven't, a lead sheet usually gives you the top line melody and sketches out the chords that underpin yeah. it, and then the rest is up to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not so different from Baroque music, you know?
So they often say about
where, you know, there would be what they called the figured bass, which would yeah. just be like, it would be a number and, you know, would tell you what the chord was and what form of the chord was. And then it was up to you to figure out what to play.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe the more general principle is theme and variations,
right,
you know, which
right.
is, that's something that's pretty universal actually.
Yeah.
And it's just that everybody has themes and variations in their parts. And so they can work off of their own parts, they can work off of the full score.
Now, I mean, hearing Far From Over on the record and now hearing it live, you know, kind of up close and in person, I heard something I hadn't noticed before, and maybe it was just me hearing things, but especially there were moments in the horns that had the kind of scalar form of South Indian music. And I don't know whether that was something intentional mm-hmm. on your part or, again, whether I'm just, you know,
no, it's
inserting what I know about you into that piece.
Well, that sort of thing has been in my music since there has been such a thing as my music, I think, which is, you know, a good quarter century, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of the rhythmic ideas come from actually several different systems, I would say. One is predominantly West African and the other is predominantly South Asian.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way they've kind of manifested in the various diasporas. But this particular song, for example, has a rhythmic cycle that's a kind of obscure Carnatic tala.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are figures in the horns that kind of tumble across it and resolve, which are a sort of typical rhythmic technique or strategy in North and South Indian music,
right.
particularly in Carnatic music.
Mm-hmm. Which is the Southern
yeah.
Indian music, yeah. So the sextet is, you know, a piano trio with three horns on top, the trumpetish thing, things that Graham plays without actually playing the trumpet, and the two saxophones. Did you set out to form that, or was it built around the fact that you wanted to play with these players?
It's a combination of those things. I mean, it's a pretty iconic format. I mean, Kind of Blue is in this format, for mm-hmm. example. But actually, in the 90s, I used to, when I lived in the Bay Area, I used to see McCoy Tyner every year. He'd do a double week. The first week would be trio, and the second week would be sextet, and it was basically in this format too. And I would just sort of get drunk on that music, basically. Yeah. You know, there's also Herbie Hancock's Sextant, that body of work from the 70s before he went down the headhunter's path.
Right.
So I guess there are a lot of different points of reference. It covers a lot of ground, but it's also pretty focused in its own way.
You know,
because it's not like there's a string section or something, and there's no guitar. So it's timbrely very specific, I'd say.
Right.
But, you know, we can get pretty orchestral with it. And so I guess that's what I tend to strive for, even with head-type arrangements like that one.
Mm-hmm.
Try to see how much ground you can cover sonically, you know.
Right. And on the album, there are moments where there's electronics happening, and, you know, it's not just the instrumentation that's here in the studio today. There's some Fender Rhodes.
I'm playing Fender Rhodes, and Graham's using a lot of electronics as well, affecting the horn. You know, he's made some landmark electronic music in his day, and it's, I've been a fan for a long time, since before I met him. You know, so I just invited him to do whatever he wants with that stuff. It's been great. It's been an ongoing exploration texturally. I also had this experience working in Wadada Leo Smith's quartet, the Golden Quartet, when I was in it for several years. That even with this economy of instrumentation, sort of straddle a wide range of possibilities with texture and with sound and with energy and different things.
So. Well, even when you and Wadada did the duo record, you know, ostensibly just trumpet and piano, and yet they were like kind of whole vistas. I mean, that album was very much about vistas, I guess.
It was, yeah.
So I guess it's in how you sort of define your sound world, and or how loosely you define it. And the more loosely it is defined, the wider the expanse you can be, I guess, looking at. This is the 10th anniversary year of the trio, right?
Oh, I don't know.
I can't be the one to inform you of this.
it depends. I mean, actually, if you go back to Reimagining, which is an album we made in 2000, we recorded it in 04, I remember, because Marcus had just voted for the first time. he had just turned 18. And it came
That's
out
Marcus
in
Gilmore,
yes. And it came out in 05. And even though it was a quartet album, it had a lot of trio material on it. And around that time, we started doing trio gigs in that format with Stefan and Marcus, which continues to this day.
So you're telling me the 10th anniversary stuff is a load of PR crap.
And oh, who said that? Somebody, I don't know. I don't write these things.
No. Do the bands swap repertoire? Is the sextet only doing sextet stuff and the trio only does trio stuff?
It actually all blends together. In fact, a lot of the trio music is kind of distillations of material from other larger formats.
Mm.
And then with this band, I try orchestrating some things that maybe are extensions of the trio music too. So it kind of goes both ways.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back to that in a little bit. But for right now, you want to do Nope?
Yeah.
Another sextet piece from the album?
Yes.
All right.
I do want to do Nope.
Vijay Iyer and his sextet here with us on this edition of Soundcheck. This is from the latest album called Far From Over, and this piece is called Nope. Thank you. That's called Nope. A work by Vijay Iyer and his sextet from the album called Far From Over. Live performance here in the studio. Kind of a fractured little boogie there. That piece called Nope. So one of the things you mentioned before, Reimaginings, that old trio record. That's the album in which you did a version of John Lennon's Imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you've come back to pop music at various points in your career, from John Lennon to M.I.A.
Yeah. It's where we all started.
Yeah. So do you still, I mean, if you were to, like, throw a cover into a set at the Village Vanguard, what would it likely be?
Oh. Now, Steve's done a lot of covers in his octet, which has a certain overlap with this band.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't entirely steal his idea, but he's done some really interesting covers, Bud Powell and Wu-Tang and different things, right? So I'll leave that to him, maybe. But no, I mean, what we might do rather than a cover is something more like an homage, you know, or some kind of tribute.
Right. But I mean, I guess the reason I'm asking is you do still follow, you still listen to pop music and...
Yeah.
Distinguished professor at
Harvard. I think I listen to old pop music, though. I let my students tell me, like, what's current and what's really happening.
And so what do you teach them up there at Harvard?
What I teach them, that's up to them to report. I guess there are sort of two categories of things I do there. One is kind of workshop courses for musicians, where we focus on the doing of music.
Mm-hmm. How to play nicely with each other.
Exactly, right. And the other is sort of more research-oriented or academic-oriented courses for undergrads and doctoral students.
Mm-hmm. So more theory of music than composition or history of music?
It's a lot of different things, I guess. And some courses are kind of hybrids. Like, there's a course I've been doing for musicians that actually makes them read and write a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
At Harvard, you can get kids to do that because you can just hold grades over their head. You know? They'll sort of try to do something, you know. So I direct the Banff program over the summer with musicians from all over the world, and that's a 3-week program. And I realized early on that you couldn't really make people read anything because they're not getting graded, and you know, they're out there trying to do their own thing. But yes, the undergrads will take the work seriously, and the doctoral students too. They've really been rising to the challenge. One of the courses I do is a kind of hybrid where it's like a workshop course, but there's a lot of reading and writing and a lot of discussion, and then that kind of gives them more of a sense of being a musician in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I guess you could say a sort of deconstructed history of jazz by looking at different collectives and different community projects, like looking at the Harlem Renaissance, looking at what they call the bebop era, looking at the creative music movement, you might say, the AACM,
and the
Black Artist Group. And it's actually not just them. It's quite a lot of different sites that were all, in a way, doing something similar. Mm-hmm. Detroit, Los Angeles, DC, you know.
Right.
So if you start looking really at that granularity, it's not one thing. It's a lot of concurrent things that have similar roots.
And do you find that you, you know, we started talking like 10, 15 years ago about people who grew up with iPods and music on shuffle and how they were, you'd have Bach next to the Beatles, next to Lester Bowie, next to David Bowie, you know? do you find that you're seeing the fruits of that? I mean, are you getting young musicians who are sort of conversant in all these different forms of music?
You know what I notice is it's not so much that. It's more that they're a little dumbfounded by the vastness of the archive. And so it almost manifests as a melancholy of some kind, in the sense that they're not sure what they should listen to now.
Well, that's all of us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. But certainly when they come to me as musicians. So what I've done is kind of the reverse. Actually, there's another course I teach called Critical Listening, which is sort of intro. It's like a sophomore tutorial for the music concentration, as it's called at Harvard, which is the music major. And the first time I did it, I just wanted to see what they were listening to. So I just asked them to write about those sounds and music that are in their lives. And that was all kinds of things. It would be video game music. It'd be film music. It'd be the fan that's making all this noise outside the window. You know, it might be some live musical experiences they had, but that's a pretty small part of it.
Huh.
Most of it is like, you know, music kind of wallpapers their lives. And
right.
They use it to sort of, and everyone, most of us too, use it to kind of structure our moods in a certain way.
Yeah.
So it was kind of about getting them to do a little bit more careful introspection about what's going on there, you know, because it's, in a way, with this hyperabundance that we have now, that literally the entire recorded archive is at your fingertips, that we need to find new ways to talk about it.
Right. I mean, when you have every option available to you, you might as well have no option available to you, you know, almost, because it's, if you don't have any restricted choice at all, there's no way to know where to begin.
Well, I think people begin by listening to what their friends are listening to or something like that. I mean, it ends up being more social, I'd say, more socially kind of determined, in the sense that there are certain things that you get exposed to and other things that might be happening right next door that you might never listen to. You know?
Well, but that's always been the case, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's why there are cult artists that people, you know, just think, how could they have missed this, you know? This guy was, you know, right next door to Count Basie or, you know, and everybody missed him.
Right.
Anyway, so I want to come back to this idea of, you know, your music, whether it's solo or duo, trio, sextet, that, you know, different ensembles can get in there and play it. One of the last times you were here was when you did the record Break Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this next piece, Taking Flight, is from that record. So it's a trio piece.
Well, that's a funny story. No, I mean, each of these, actually a lot of the music on that album and on the sextet album trace its roots to a suite of music that I created with Teju Cole 5 years ago. He basically took some extracts from his novel Open City, and I did a suite for a large ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And he read, you know, 7 or 8 sections from it, interspersed throughout this large ensemble music. A lot of the pieces on Break Stuff and on Far From Over are actually, they have some relationship to that project. So this is one of them. Basically, what he did when we did that project, as you may know, the novel has a pretty interesting sweep to it. It's a first-person kind of digressive. The guy's kind of a flaneur, so he spends a lot of time walking around New York City and has these encounters, and that's basically what the novel is. So there are a lot of characters in it, but there's a sort of monologue version of the book where it's just these episodes that the narrator has encountering birds. And there's about, there's like 7 or 8 of them. So those are the pieces that he chose. So there's a kind of pervasive birds theme. As you may remember from the trio album, there's starlings, there's geese, there's wrens. So this is another one of those pieces, and we call it Taking Flight.
All right. Well, let's hear what the sextet makes of it. Today, they're here for another installment of the Soundcheck podcast. This piece is called Taking Flight. Thank you. That's called Taking Flight, a final live performance from the Vijay Iyer Sextet here in our Soundcheck studio. So, Vijay, that was originally a large ensemble piece. Was this for ICE, the International
Contempt? No, it was a bunch of people from our side. No. It was actually Graham and Mark were both in it.
So there was a trio version. Now there's a sextet version. And the trio is performing June 16th at Le Poisson Rouge.
That's right.
So, but it's been great having the sextet here with us on Soundcheck today. Vijay, great to see you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you for letting us take over for a little while.
It's been a takeover by the Vijay Iyer Sextet on Soundcheck. That's all for this Soundcheck podcast. Hear other Soundcheck podcasts and see other videos online at newsounds.org. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Our associate producer is Karen Havlick. Our video producer is Justin Sergi. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.